Hello, you are listening to Screen. Joining me today is Sasha.
Hi.
Beth.
Hello.
Matthew.
Hello.
And
Sam.
Sam. I was going to say something else. And I'm Liam, as always. That doesn't change. So, this week we will be reviewing The Hunger Games, Mockingjay, part two. I won't do the extra bit that I always do because it's a really tired joke now. But it has something to do with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And we will also be reviewing Black Mass with Johnny Depp, which I haven't seen, but seems kind of interesting. But first, as always, we will be talking about what films YSC, Yorkshire Cinema, is playing this week. Mm-hmm. So, what do we have tonight?
So, this evening is Absolutely Anything, the film where a group of aliens give Simon Pegg superpowers. Tomorrow night is Southpaw, and Monday is Me and Earl and the Guy and Girl.
Okay. Has anyone seen any of these films?
No.
No. I wanted to see Southpaw, but it seemed to sort of disappear from cinemas around the time that it came into cinemas. I think Southpaw is what's it called? Gyllenhaal, however you say it, punching people in a ring or something. I think his wife dies and he takes some drugs and his daughter leaves him, and so he has to beat up some more people to get custody of his daughter back, which sounds like a riveting performance. But I mean,
there are quite a few
films that have like a kind of a central character who is, you know, a boxer or a wrestler or something that tends to like surprise people and are really interesting, and maybe this film is a kind of hidden gem. Possibly. Absolutely Anything wasn't very popular.
No.
Has the entire surviving cast of Monty Python in it, and even that doesn't manage to save it, or hasn't saved the box office sales at least. I don't know. Any of you guys planning to see either of these?
I wanted to see Me, Earl and the Dying Girl when it was out.
Yes.
Because it got such good reviews at Sundance. So I might go and see it on Monday.
Yeah, Me, Earl and the Dying Girl is a kind of indie film about the character who refers to himself as me in the title, and his friend Earl, who make a sort of series of really kind of low budget, awful little films with each other for fun, and then they discover the dying girl, the titular dying girl, and make films for her or something to cheer her up, something along those lines. Sounds very heartwarming and, you know,
nice
and uplifting. No, I'm sure it's very good because it gets critical praise from pretty much everyone I respect. So so should we just run over those three films again just to make sure people know? We have on Thursday
Absolutely Anything,
on Friday
Southpaw,
and on Monday
Me and Earl and the Guy and Girl.
Cool. And do you want to just say what time doors open or film starts or someone, just in case people don't know?
Sure, yeah. So doors open 6:45, film starts around 7:30.
Okay, cool. All right, thanks a lot.
Cool.
What should we review first? Beth, do you have an idea? I mean, Sash, you seem very keen to review Black Mass, so
she's jumping up and down.
I loved Black Mass.
Should we just go straight into it then? Black Mass?
Yeah, definitely.
Sure.
I'm
Do you want to give
it.
Us a brief kind of overview of the idea of the film, and then I'll hopefully play a clip?
Okay, so it's based on a true story about a gang called the Winter Hill Gang, kind of mob gangsters, small time criminals in Boston, and then how that develops. And how their crime syndicate kind of grows, and involvement with the FBI and things. Mm.
Okay, let's have a go. Hopefully this will work.
And Morris, what did you marinate the steak in? Because it's out of this world. You're killing me with...
No.
It's a family secret. Oh.
Come on, you gotta tell me that. Come on, you could do it. Come on. What's the family secret recipe?
It's ground garlic, and a little bit of soy.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
I thought it was a family secret.
It's a recipe.
No. You said to me, this is a family secret, and you gave it up to me, boom. Don't look to John, because he's not going to help you. You spill the secret family recipe today, maybe you spill about me tomorrow. Is that something maybe that's a possibility?
That's what I was just saying.
You were just saying. Just saying gets people sent to Allenwood. Just saying could get you buried real quick.
Your marinade is amazing. What do you think?
Well, that kind of that trailer is actually a really good example of the feel of the film. It is quite, I feel a lot of, I'm really into this kind of film with mobs and gangsters and that kind of vibe, and a lot of films have tried to do the mounting tension and the feeling of a noose closing or a trap closing around the protagonists, and
the walls closing in.
Yeah, and it doesn't always work, or it'll work to an extent, but it doesn't really draw the audience in. For me, this film ticked those boxes. The tension was built up slowly throughout. From the beginning, you're kind of like, oh, he's not such a bad guy. He's okay. You know, he loves his like old ladies on the street and things like that. And as you go through, there's a certain point where the trap is closing in.
Mm-hmm.
And I genuinely, when I was watching it, felt like it was closing in on me as well. I was sitting there watching it going, oh, this is so tense. This is so tense. What's going to happen? So for me, it ticked all those boxes.
So a very engrossing film.
Yeah. And it didn't glamorize the violence in it. It wasn't a lot of violence for the sake of violence. I felt that when the violence was introduced, it was brutal and it was to the point, and it was quite hard hitting. It didn't make you walk away from it thinking, I want to be a gangster. It made you walk away from it thinking, wow.
No, I feel that we're sort of oversaturated in sort of films and TV shows with sort of excessive violence at this point. And speaking of which, another Tarantino film's coming out soon. yeah, so I felt listening to that clip that there's, I mean, I haven't seen this film.
Mm-hmm.
I should state first, but there's this kind of cliche in all these films where they have a kind of a psychopathic gangster who rises to the top, is that he always sort of asks a question and then sort of gets the answer that he's given the answer that they think he expects, but then he sort of twists that around and he manipulates their words and basically just has a go at them.
Yeah.
And sort of there's no way out. There's no way for them to kind of justify themselves, as it were. That happens in seemingly every one of these films. Does it play to a lot of the tropes of a kind of gangster film?
I think that it does to an extent. I think that you go into it expecting it to play to the tropes of a gangster film, and in a way it satisfies your expectations but then turns them a little bit. Like, I think you expect him, I went in expecting him to be completely like gun-toting psychopath who just had no regard for human life, but he does have his own moral system.
Yeah, it's more calculating, isn't it?
Yeah. I feel like it's definitely not as, it's not as formulaic as you think it's going
to
be.
Well, I mean, that sounds like a trope to me, the kind of the psychopath who will happily, you know, beat someone to death, but then sort of helps an old lady across the street. Oh, how clever. Oh, perhaps he has a good side to him. Oh, is it all a game to him? I mean, I think that's overplayed a lot.
Yeah, but I think that there's quite good character development with the character of Jimmy Bulger. Like, it's not that he begins as the character that he ends up as. I think that there is a journey made throughout the film that you can see him, like his paranoia mounts and his touchiness with regards different people and different situations and being ratted out, that all mounts. It's not like he begins as one character and just continues on, which happens a lot in those type
films.
It is
a trope, but it grows into one. Because like at the beginning, I was trying to work out what he'd done wrong. So like they build up this idea that he's a criminal, but you don't see him doing anything out of line. Uh-huh. He's being a good brother and a good son and everything. Like, you don't actually see him do anything except for, like, to be in this kind of scenario where he seems like he's the gangster, but he doesn't actually do anything to make it seem like that. Whereas it shows the growth in that, and it shows how he made it to the big time and actually got to that, and shows the whole brutality of it.
Yeah, because it is. I mean, I don't know how faithful it is, but it's based on a true story.
Yeah,
this film.
It's actually really, because I was looking up things about it afterwards, which, because it actually really interested me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really close to the point of some of the murder scenes were shot in the same places that the murders took place.
They were so faithful they actually did the murders.
Yeah. They're still there.
Went through a lot of extras.
Okay. One thing I'd like to ask is because neither of you have mentioned it yet, but the trailers very much play to this idea that there's a kind of, how shall I put this? There's a kind of this idea of kind of bonds between different characters based on where they grew up and how they grew up.
Yeah.
There's one character who's in the FBI who has a kind of local relationship with Johnny Depp's character.
Mm-hmm.
Is that played as much in the film as is in the trailers?
Definitely. I think it is a big element, and it's an important part of the story in terms of how they both end up relying on each other quite a lot. And the reason that the FBI agent ends up kind of like this relationship ends up growing.
It's
like a catalyst for everything.
So that
the corruption of Joel Edgerton, who is really good in it, and as the FBI agent who makes the alliance with the gang, it feeds in everything. That's what helps it grow to the extent that it did.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I do have to say is that if you go and see this film, you have to prepare for Benedict Cumberbatch putting on an accent that is perhaps not the best Boston accent you ever heard in your life.
I thought it was rather good, actually. But that being said, I'm not from Boston. So. Oh, does it? Okay. Well, I mean, I
think
I only
his laugh still
clip.
Sounds English, which is what kind of tripped me up. Every time he laughed, yeah.
So what, thick Bostonian accent followed by...
I mean, I should mention it's a star-spangled cast. Mm. It's got a lot of celebrities in this one. Adam Scott, Benedict Cumberbatch, as we said, Johnny Depp.
Could I actually say something on that?
Because of course.
The elephant in the room here is that this is kind of quite obviously being sold as Johnny Depp kind of reminding people that he's a real actor.
That's essentially what
considering. For a long, long time, he's kind of been coasting on variations on Jack Sparrow. Well, Tim Burton will come to him and say, can we do Jack Sparrow but with a hat?
Put some makeup on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he did a good job in reassorting himself in that serious field, though. I really did think that it was
so
a good
job. He's good in this.
He's very good in this.
Even though it's a massive cast and a good cast, he did steal it. There were some people in, like, some of the actors in his gang, like Rory Cochrane and Joel Edgerton, like, they were maybe on a similar level to him, but he did take it the extra mile.
So he's the best actor.
Yeah, Adam Scott, I have a problem with, because he's a comedic actor and he's a very good comedic actor, but they cast him and he didn't really do anything. He wasn't comedic and he wasn't, like, he didn't really have a very good drama face either.
Oh really? No. Like, I'm just a fan of Adam Scott's because of
Sunny in
Philadelphia.
But he didn't do any...
No, not Sunny in Philadelphia. No. Sorry, that's Parks and Rec.
And Party Down. Yeah, I really like Adam Scott, but he wasn't needed in the film.
He was kind of a big name for the sake of having a big name.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I saw there's a clip where it is what appears to be kind of FBI offices, and there's Adam Scott and there's Kevin Bacon, there's a few others, and they're in a room talking about whether they should kind of, I believe, bring on Johnny Depp as an informant or something along those lines. And every FBI person in there, except for the kind of main FBI
John
character,
John Connolly.
Everyone has very little dialogue, I felt. Yeah. It seems like they kind of split a lot of dialogue up between a lot of different people.
Yeah, it could have been with anyone.
Is that not necessary, do you think?
I feel like, I mean, Kevin Bacon could have taken on all of Adam Scott's role, really, without you really noticing a gap, I don't think.
I think they just wanted, because there's one FBI guy who kind of converts and is sucked into it, so I think they probably just wanted the difference between
the dichotomy of,
okay, all right, but overall you both recommend seeing this film.
I love this film.
It's grown on me, because I came out of it like liking it but kind of being sat next to someone being like, I that was amazing. But yeah, it's grown on me overnight. It's been
okay, cool, all right, that's Black Mass reviewed then. Matthew, should we move on to bashing the Hunger Games?
I'm not necessarily going to bash it. I'm just going to make conflicted noises
and
maim it.
Anyway, no. We'll both sort of go and give a kind of review, I imagine. But anyway, do you want to give us a brief synopsis as best as you can when there's already three films behind this film?
Yeah, I was going to say. So yeah, here we finally get the second half of the last film. It leaves off from there. The last one is, so spoilers for the last one, but something jolly nasty has happened to Peter. And
Peter, of course, is the main love interest for Jennifer Lawrence. Do we need to add this? I'm not sure. I mean,
there's so much internal logic now, isn't
there's
there?
So, well, there's so much story. I mean, well, I say there's so much story, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things we need to say, a lot of characters to introduce to make any sense of it.
Okay, Katniss, part of Revolution. They all wear grey and Julianne Moore is their boss. Go.
Yes. Well, we should say, okay, basically, the kind of the end days of the revolution are near. Mm-hmm. They have a large the capital, the central city, the cradle of evil, as it were, has kind of been rigged with numerous nasty traps. Numerous nasty traps, I tell you. At the same time that Katniss is trying to sort of get through this war zone, she's also being kind of portrayed as a political symbol. She's being used to gain support rather than fighting, which is kind of where her interest is. Anyway, let's try giving a clip a go.
Finnick? Are you with us?
Looks like it.
That's a short honeymoon.
Yeah, well, I guess we're gonna have to have one in the capital after we take it.
Gather around. Squad 451, you're my unit. Lieutenant Jackson is my second in command. Each one of you is elite in some form of combat, but we are a non-combat unit, so we'll be following days behind the frontline troops.
You're to be the on-screen faces of the invasion, the Star Squad. It's been decided that you're most effective when seen by the masses.
So we're not going
to
fight.
You do whatever you're ordered to do, soldier. It's not your job to ask questions.
Yes, sir. Even though we'll be working on abandoned streets miles behind the front lines, I guarantee you, wherever they put us, it will not be safe. This is a war zone. It is likely that we'll encounter both active pods and peacekeepers. You're considered high-value targets to the capital. Our unit has been given a holo, a database that contains a detailed map of the capital and a list of every known pod. These pods can trigger anything from bombs to traps to mutts. Whatever they contain, they are meant to kill you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 76 Hunger Games.
Big,
very, very
noise.
Dramatic there. Yes. That's the commander of the unit failing to recognize that bombs are indeed traps. You don't need to say bombs and traps. They're the same thing.
As if they're two distinct things, yeah. You can't really discuss this, the last part of the Hunger Games, without discussing the franchise as a whole.
Yes.
And really, to me, the franchise as a whole has been defined by... It's essentially just a collection of unfinished ideas and half-baked ideas. In the sense that in the first one, you have this actually... Admittedly, it's quite on the nose, but you have a social satire going on. In the sense that, you know, this whole televising of children dying is sort of the logical punchline to, let's, you know, the sort of brutality that we have in our own reality TV, and the fact that we're quite happy to cannibalistically enjoy the suffering of others as long as it's on TV. It was a bit on the nose.
That might be adding a slight sort of intellectual veneer to something that perhaps is not as advanced as
I'm nothing if not poncy about completely about things
fair
which
enough,
don't matter.
Fair enough.
But there's at least something going on there, and I feel like that was kind of the strongest idea that the series had. And then when you get to Mockingjay, that's kind of abandoned in favour of this whole idea of Katniss, you know, being the symbol of a revolution, and kind of like playing into a bit of a meta-narrative in the sense that, you know, the books really, what people always say about the books is Katniss is just such a good role model for young girls, and then it actually puts her in a position of having to be a role model to a revolution, and it's something that she's massively uncomfortable with, and you kind of see the sausage being made in a sense, and that you see the what goes into the propaganda videos, and it's all thoroughly uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But watching Mockingjay Part 1, it did feel like that was an interesting idea that wasn't given its full time, because obviously it's half a movie.
Yes.
So I was hoping that we'd get the logical conclusion to that with this film, and we just sort of don't. I think the biggest ideological message that shines through in Mockingjay Part 2 is that war is very bad. And
well, I mean, the film does play with this idea that kind of that in truth everyone is playing Snow's game. Snow is the kind of the evil dictator who's played rather well. But I mean, it's not fleshed out. I mean, I feel the entire series has very much wrestled with this kind of this evolution. It starts off as a really tacky kind of teen drama. Like I felt that it really didn't have much kind of intellectual or worth to it. I mean, that's a very poncy thing to say, I suppose, but there you go. And it's over time, it's slowly kind of broken out of that shell and become a kind of, I think, a interesting political thriller. But the sad thing is that with each new film, it's got slightly better at being a political thriller, I think. It's very much started to play with this idea of kind of propaganda and the kind of the fake nature of this kind of having a symbol, a martyr for a revolution.
Embodied by Philip Seymour Hoffman's very cynical character.
Yes, but I think the tragedy of this film is if this was the first film of a series and I knew it was going to keep improving that kind of political aspect, I'd be really, really psyched to see what comes next. Unfortunately, this is the last one and I can't help feeling a bit kind of, I don't know, whelmed. Just sort of not really like, yeah.
I know you can be underwhelmed and I know you can be overwhelmed,
but I'm just sort of just whelmed.
And there's, I don't know, I felt very whelmed also, but you've touched on the performances. There's tons of excellent actors in this. And yes, like you say, President Snow being played by Donald Sutherland, like such a charismatic figure who's never given anything really to do in any of the films. He just kind of shows up as a slightly foreboding presence who, you know, looks at a rose and then sort of laconically smiles at somebody he's about to kill or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically his character, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's an awful lot of this film that starts out with Josh Hutcherson just kind of wallowing. He does an awful lot of wallowing in this film. Lots of sort of wandering around going, oh, nothing is beautiful, everything hurts, every step is a new nightmare.
Well, and I mean, he has been tortured. Bear in mind. That is something I like to touch on. That, I mean, it's kind of a symbolic of how it's kind of emerging from a teen drama, is it starts off as this kind of, well, as a game, really, but then in this film, it very much shows you the kind of the aftermath of those things, that all of these victors, as they were, they've all lost. They're all losers in a sense. They're all kind of broken and crippled things in a sense, except for, you know, Katniss. She's just great and runs around with a bow and kicks.
Oh no, she's totally broken. She's totally broken. Okay. I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay,
there.
But generally they all suffer and have nightmares and scream and are sort of twisted individuals by the end of it. And I think that's kind of symbolic of it reaching maturity. But anyway, we should get back to performances. Do you think the person in charge of casting has watched too much Game of Thrones?
Because I do. Because Gwendolyn Christie shows up at the very start.
They got Natalie Dormer in the third film, and she was largely insubstantial. And then they got Gwendolyn Christie in this film as well, who has rolled on for about a minute to do a really, really bad accent and then rolled off again, and you never see it once.
She's literally there, and you can feel it as though the casting director at the premiere must have sort of jumped up and down and said, look who I got to be in this.
The kids, they love Game of Thrones. They'll love this. Actually, Game of Thrones, that's a good segue. I probably shouldn't remark on it. That makes it a bad segue. But I feel that it was very restrained in... Well, it wasn't... It was very well done in how it kills characters, I felt, because it didn't go for that kind of Game of Thrones orgy of character death. Like, you know what? At the end of this series, I'm just going to kill all of these characters all in one fell swoop. It doesn't do that, because I find this is exhausting. It's like, oh, okay, fine, all right, I've lost a character, like, oh, there's another one, and you start just counting them off and it just gets dull.
Yes, they do go without ceremony here.
It kills off characters who have been in other films, who are substantive characters, who you kind of, you know, yeah, this, I like this one, I like that one, characters you support, some of them you've been with from the beginning. It doesn't have much of an issue with killing them, but it paces it out well enough that it isn't exhausting. It's still kind of impactful. There's a particular death near the end that I was like, I was very surprised by. It's probably not the one, Matthew, that you think I'm talking about. There's a scene with the death and some amazing high heels. That's not the one I'm talking about. That was obviously going to happen.
I think we're getting a bit too inside baseball.
We are getting a bit too inside, yes. But I mean, actually, that's a good point. That it does. Its idea of villains is very childish.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It does have. I mean, as I said, there's a scene. It's got a balcony with no guardrail, amazing high heels, fantastic grey outfit, and just this massive crowd in a huge stadium, and it's all very kind of Sith, you know, the kind of evil empire. You can almost hear the
Imperial March going on in the background. Yeah. What I would say on performances, just, you know, before we go on to talk about something else, what this is sorely lacking is what has been the greatest part of all of the Hunger Games franchise, which is Stanley Tucci as Caesar Flickerman being the Graham Norton of this universe.
Well, actually, I mean, he is in this film for about a minute.
Yeah.
And I thought it was just sort of, they were like, oh, hold on, we haven't got this character in, because they've the whole, you know, the story, the genesis of Hunger Games has kind of gotten out of control. There's too many characters. They have to sort of kill a few off there, say, oh, that one went that way over there. Oh, quickly have a video screen with this character on for a minute, just to sort of make sure all our bases are covered. And it pulls itself in a bit too many directions on that front. He's very much rolled on for a minute, talks, and then he's just rolled off, and you never see from him again. Though it would be relevant to hear from him again later in the film.
Which was just frustrating, because he was always one of the most interesting and probably the best performance in the whole lot.
Oh, you really
just,
think so?
Oh, I think just in terms of completely going for broke and just chewing as much scenery as he could fit in his mouth.
I mean, I found him infuriating, and it was just so irritating. But I mean, maybe that's his character. I think that kind of works, because I find Graham Norton fairly irritating as well. So
sacrilege.
Yes, I know. I will be torn limb from limb as soon as I leave this studio. Yeah. Is there anything else we really need to remark upon on this film?
Can I just ask, someone who hasn't really watched any of the Hunger Games series, are the morals, you were talking about the villains being kind of cartoonishly villainous, are the morals very much black and white? Are there any grey characters? Is there any kind of moral uncertainty? Or is everything very much, this is the good thing to do and this is the bad thing to do?
If anything, I think this film is kind of the moral uncertainty underlined to the whole thing. Well, I think there's a lot of sort of like, you know, oh, you know, the whole idea of drawing up sides is, you know, maybe that was all a bit silly. But it's delivered in just quite a muted and not very impactful way.
Yeah, I mean, the spectre of, sorry to bring philosophy into this, but the spectre of Nietzsche does hang over, you know, one should not fight with monsters, at least one become a monster themselves, and staring into the abyss and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does have an element of that. It's not fully fleshed out, because as I said, it's still wrestling with being a teen drama.
Yeah.
But
somebody has to have something for the teens. The teens have to react to something.
I mean, they're just not marketed to.
They've got their tumblers and their tweets and so on. You know.
Yeah. I would say in relation to it being in terms of like tone, in relation to it being YA fiction, a comparison you could draw with this one is with Harry Potter. In the sense that you mentioned,
in the sense that they split the tone of film into two.
There's that, but then everyone's doing.
Yeah, everyone does that now. Well, Harry Potter.
And it gets darker, is it?
Yeah, the tone changes as it progresses. I think with Harry Potter, the fact it was basically a decade, and you literally, especially our generation, literally grew up in real time with these characters. Mm-hmm. It kind of mirrors the maturing of somebody's worldview, where it starts out kind of kiddish and fantasy, and ends as, you know, quite moody and introspective. I feel like The Hunger Games didn't have a big enough lifespan to justify the jump in tone that it makes.
I suppose. I mean, I haven't read the books myself, but they're rather hefty. I mean, they're big, so it's a big story to grapple with. So I can understand if there is a kind of, I mean, the films are supposed to be representative of the books, right? And there is a kind of, I would expect some kind of tonal shift across three books, you'd hope. So I can understand if I think it's fair enough for them to kind of become significantly darker by the end of this.
When did the first film come out? Like, what is the lifespan of the film franchise been?
I don't know.
Okay, well,
I'm not going to Google it because it sounds
do
awful
you feel hair. that the characters have grown up? Do you leave the cinema with the sense that the characters have matured compared to the first one, which I've seen bits of?
Yes. Oh god, it's actually really close to the end. yes, we're going to quickly answer that. We've been screened. I think our view on Hunger Games final film is a bit meh, really.
It's a bit meh.
Anyway, up next is the York Sport Report. York Uni's official student radio station.